Good morning. It's just about 9 o'clock here at KBOO Portland. It's Friday. It's the third Friday. It's time for Veterans Voice coming up momentarily. Marvin's guest today is Randy Rowland, an activist who was busy in San Francisco, and he'll be telling us all about that. Also, Valley Views at 10 o'clock talks to a City of Corvallis labor union leader about common conflicts and confusion that employees have with unions. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, Between the Covers features author Stephen O'Donnell and Gigi Little talking about their new book, The Untold Gaze. And all of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you want to be a member and support us, you can go to kboo.fm and click where it says donate, and that would be much appreciated if you take care of that. Thank you. Let's listen to a couple of announcements and then Veterans Voice.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society's concert season, which this month features the Kathy Kallick Bluegrass Band, October 19th, 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. Kathy Kallick is an award-winning singer-songwriter, having received a Grammy and international bluegrass music accolades. Her five-piece band features more IBMA winners, including local fiddler Annie Staninetz, a former Emerging Artist of the Year. Portland Folk Music Society concerts in November will bring the Honey Whiskey Trio and Legends of the Celtic Harp with Patrick Ball on a special pre-holiday program. PFS presents concerts monthly, now through next May. For more information, go to the website, kboo.fm, and look on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the St. Seneca Show on Saturday, October 20th at 9 p.m. at the Doug Fir Lounge in Portland. St. Seneca is an American folk rock band from Columbus, Ohio that was formed in 2007 by singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist Zach Little. They are known for their diverse instrumentation of traditional and contemporary international instruments. Also playing will be Trace Mountains. Again, that's the St. Seneca Show on Saturday, October 20th at 9 p.m. at the Doug Fir Lounge, 830 East Burnside Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me, and brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.
Sisters and brothers, welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland in the Vancouver area, and 104.3 FM in Willamette Valley, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia River Gorge, or on the web at www.kbo.fm. And if you want, you can hear some of our older shows at kboo.fm/Veterans Voice. I'm Marvin, and Tammy's engineering today. She's engineered for us for a long time, and we're lucky to have her. Today we're going to talk to Randy Rowland. And Randy last time I was here, I talked about Long Binh Jail in Vietnam and the rebellion there that really tore that place apart. That was in just north of Saigon in Vietnam, where the soldiers that were in that jail just got tired of the way they were being treated, and they just rebelled against it. And what was really interesting, the majority of the people in that jail were black, were African Americans, were black, and they're the ones that put it together and decided that we've had enough of this. And also in Vietnam during the war, there were a lot of during the fighting, that a lot of the soldiers, black and white, decided, no, we're not going to do this anymore. And the black soldiers said, especially there was one thing that happened that I still remember, was the captain wanted a platoon to go down this trail that they'd just been down and had to fight their way out of. And they sent him down again and had to fight their way out of, and they got pretty bloodied. And so the black soldiers got together and got with the whites and the Hispanics and said, we're not doing this anymore. And refused to go back down. And the captain, you know, warrior, I'm going to, you know, you're going to put you in jail and all this stuff. We're not going to do it. But they said no, and they didn't do it. And, you know, they stood together. And like in the Long Binh Jail, the same thing happened. It was interesting because the person who ran the prison was a black, I think he was a colonel or a major. And he went and, you know, he talked to the guys, and he thought, well, you know, I'm black and they're black, we'll get this settled. And he, you know, they said, we're tired of this. So it was pretty interesting. And what we're going to talk about today is in the States, at the Presidio in San Francisco, in a jail there where the soldiers got tired of it, and one of the soldiers got killed. And that's when Randy and the rest of them did what they did. So we're going to talk to Randy today. And Randy, are you there?
Good morning.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I'm just fine, thanks.
And great. Yourself? Yeah. I introduced you here. And before we get into it, I want you to talk about before this happened, how you enlisted and how you changed your mind. Could you talk about that before we get into the mutiny?
Sure. So I joined the Army. I wasn't super gung-ho, but on the other hand, I certainly believe that a person should pay their dues for living in the country. Mm-hmm. And you know, I still believe that, as far as that goes, that you know, we all have to pitch in order to make it a good place, you know, pick up the litter and be decent neighbors and contribute in all the different ways that a person's supposed to contribute to society. And I believed all that and still do. So at any rate, I knew the draft was coming my way, and so I joined the Army. Had no reason to believe that there was anything wrong with the Vietnam War, which was raging at the time, because I'd been raised in a conservative family and really hadn't thought a whole lot about it, but I, you know, just nothing had come my way to make me examine or really challenge my, you know, whatever beliefs I've been raised with.
Right.
So I was a medic in the Army, and I was stationed at Fort Lewis, which is just south of Tacoma, Washington, I live in Seattle now, but in those days, of course, I was, I mean, I had never been to the Northwest, but so I was stationed in Fort Lewis, and I was taking care of the wounded,
mm-hmm.
and which, of course, is what's in a military hospital, at least during times of war. And the thing with it is that those guys, I was particularly, it was on a unit that had guys who had caught a fragment in their spine or head and neck injuries, and so they're, you know, paralyzed from some point down, and you know they're only 19 years old or, you know, young guys, because that's who goes to war, and their circumstance was so horrible, from my point of view as kind of a relatively young medic, is that I thought, damn, there better be a awful good reason for this, for these guys is to suffer the way they are. And the guys themselves, not a single one of them thought that they had made their sacrifice for a good cause. You know, they were all just, you know, returned from, you know, medevac from Vietnam and you know, ended up at the hospital there where I was taking care of them. And none of them felt like they had made their sacrifice for a good cause. You know, they gave me stories about abusing the Vietnamese and you know, of fruitless, senseless duty and of, you know, exploitation rather than, you know, defending America and, you know, all the kind of glorious things that, you know, that I had up until that point assumed was going on. And so the combination of their suffering and their report of what the war in Vietnam was really all about made me, you know, it challenged me, and I just thought, I've got to figure this out, because this is really
hard.
You know, this isn't right.
Right. Hard.
And so I started looking into it, and it didn't take me too long looking into it, before I decided, well, you know, the war, these wounded guys are telling me the truth, and the war really is, it really does suck,
mm-hmm.
and that caused me to start really challenging my, you know, my belief system a little bit, and at a certain point, because I had trained to be a medic down at Fort Sam Houston with some conscientious objectors, not the kind that don't go in the military, but the kind that just don't carry a gun,
right?
They carry the aid bag, but they won't carry the gun,
mm-hmm.
and those guys had all impressed me in my training, because they were tended to be really honorable, upright kind of fellows. And you know, not complainers, you know, pretty tough in a way, but not in a violent way. You know, they weren't violent guys. They were what the Army calls non-combatants, which just means they don't carry the gun.
Right. There's quite a few of those guys.
Yeah, a lot of those guys. And because there's two different kinds of conscience objectors to this day. You know, you can either say, I refuse to go into the military and I won't serve, because I don't believe in all that business,
mm-hmm.
for whatever reasons. Or you can say, I'll go in the military, but I won't carry a gun. I won't shoot somebody. And that's the kind that I was training with down at Fort Sam. And those fellows had been pretty consistently honorable men, and it impressed me. And I think they must have left a little impression on me that lasted, because when it came my turn to start thinking things through, well, of course my thoughts turned to those fellows. And I said, you know, I like that. I like that stand of I'm not going to be the guy that will put some other human being from whatever side in a hospital, you know, suffering in the way that my patients are suffering. I just won't do that. I still believed in serving my country and, you know, all that. I wasn't trying to get out of the Army. I just didn't want to be the guy who pulled the trigger and caused somebody else to be in the condition of the fellows that I was taking care of.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at first I wasn't even thinking about the Vietnamese, frankly. You know, I mean, later I started realizing how, you know,
the damage,
what their circumstance,
yeah.
was. But at first I wasn't even thinking about them. I was just thinking about the American soldiers that I was taking care of and their suffering and the horror of their circumstance. You know, I mean, when you can't even turn the page of a book or poop by yourself or feed yourself,
yeah.
You know, you're 19, your girlfriend's 17 and shows up and visits you one time and never comes back.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the horror is just too much to bear. you know, just psychologically, those guys were just hell. It was just, you know, it really was a wake-up call for me.
Right.
I decided to apply to be a conscientious objector.
Wow, way to go.
Time, like I was describing. And I went to my commander. You know, I was kind of a naive guy. And so I went to my commander and just asked to talk to him. And I said, you know, I'm thinking about applying to be a conscientious objector, and told him all about what my thinking was. And he said, well, don't do that, man. You'll just bring heat on yourself. You know, don't make trouble.
You don't make waves. Yeah.
Don't make waves. Just go along with the program. Excuse me. And you know, he tried to convince me, you know, not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He says, look, I'll never ask you to pick up a gun. You're working in a hospital here. You know, nobody's asking you to carry a gun anyway.
Let me ask you something. How many guys were in your ward and how long were you in the Army before you decided to become a conscientious objector? How many guys were you guys taking care of?
Oh, well, the hospital was full of different people in different wards. You know, the ward I'm describing was the neurology and neurosurgery ward, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, and but there were other wards, so...
That was the ones where the paralyzed fellows, you
okay.
know, or the head injured fellows.
Gotcha.
And you know, that was a ward full, I don't know, 20 or 30 guys. I don't know. I can't remember
well.
That. But, you know, just one hospital ward in one hospital. There's lots of hospitals.
Yeah.
So, they would come back to hospitals around America if they made it back that far in the system.
Right.
You know, a lot of people went to Japan first, and then they would end up, they'd get treated in the field. Medevac to Japan, then ultimately come to a hospital in the United States.
In the States, right. So how long were Randy, how long were you in the Army? How long were you in the Army before you decided to be a CO?
Oh, probably a year or so.
Wow.
I'm about a year, I would guess.
Was there any threats at that time to go to Vietnam? Was there any threats for you to be levied to Vietnam at that time?
Well, not right then.
Okay.
I had a duty station,
go ahead.
There were other wars. There was people have seen that movie, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and you know, there's a scene in the movie which was quite real in Madigan back in those days. Where the guys hold the basketball and can't shoot the basketball.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was times when I worked, for instance, on the psych ward, and in those days, the way they treated everybody that was, their mind had been blown by the war.
Mm-hmm.
It was what we called the maintenance dose. We used Thorazine in those days.
Right.
The maintenance dose is you would give a guy enough Thorazine to where he couldn't walk, and then once he couldn't walk anymore, then you'd back off the dose a little bit until he could just barely walk, and that was the maintenance dose. And it was really wasn't a dose to try and help a fella. You know, it was a dose to control a guy is what it was. And so they would just walk around like zombies.
Mm.
And, you know, you'd take them out for recreation or something, and they'd literally just stand around, you know, not playing basketball, but just holding the basketball in their hand or staring in the space, or because they could barely function. Now, that wasn't a dose that would allow them to work out their psychological problems.
Mm.
That was a dose just to control them so that they wouldn't be violent and so that they, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, you know, I thought it was kind of weird, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. Yeah,
but you know, everything was weird those days. We were in the middle of a war against people. In retrospect, that hadn't asked for war, and you know, we were the ones that were, it was that old thing where they told the soldiers, if we don't stop them over there, then we'll have to stop them over here.
Yep.
And then when the fellows got over to Vietnam, they realized that the Vietnamese didn't even have a damn navy. So how were they going to come over here and invade us?
Exactly. Yeah.
But
go ahead.
Now you realize at that time
okay.
is when I started realizing the lie.
Yeah.
At any rate, I did apply to be a conscientious objector, but I didn't get any help from anybody. I was unsophisticated, and frankly, I did a really lousy job of my application because I just didn't, you know, all of these things are legal procedures, and like anything, you know, if you're going to get approved, you're going to have to say the magic words, whatever they are. You know, somebody has already specified in case law or in the rules what the magic words are that you got to say in order to meet the to meet the standards of whatever you're trying to be, do. And I didn't know all about that, and so I just poured my heart out onto, you know, on the form. I, you know, my commander finally relented and gave me the form to fill out, and I filled the form out as best I could and turned it in. You know, eventually I came back denied.
Yeah.
And, about the same time, well, of course, along came my orders to Vietnam.
Whoa. Yeah. What year was that? 68, right?
That was probably early 68. Yeah.
Okay.
By the time I got my orders, it was early 68. So, of course, once you're on orders for Vietnam, then pretty soon I got orders to go to the firing range and familiarize myself with the M16. Because we, in basic training, we had trained with M14s.
And
it was a way different weapon. And so I said, well, go report to the firing range. And so I went up to my commander, you know, the lieutenant, and I said, don't you remember when I came to you and talked to you man-to-man, and you told me that you would never ask me to pick up a gun? And now here you are telling me to report to the firing range, to, you know, to pick up a weapon. And I said, you told me you would never do that. He says, well, I'm not the one that's going to tell you to pick up the gun. It's going to be the colonel.
Whoa. Colonel.
You know, just, you know, just to make, you know, I thought, I felt so betrayed because I had gone to him. Oh, well, I won't be the one. It'll be the colonel. Like, oh, well, thanks. Yeah. Well, at any rate, I went out to the firing range, and I sat there. You know, first you have to learn how to break the gun down and put it back together and all that kind of stuff. And so I just left mine, you know, my M16 sitting there on the table in front of me. Everybody's sitting at these long tables while you're doing this. And one of my buddies, just by happenstance, was out there, so he sat next to me, and he was having trouble breaking his down and putting it back together, so when nobody was looking, I would reach over and I'd help him do his. But I left mine alone, right? Which was kind of a clown act, but hey, that's the way it was. And then came the moment when I was supposed to go out and, you know, fire the damn
thing. Yeah.
So, and sure enough, here comes the brass up to give me my orders, and I refused. I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And which, of course, could possibly have given me a 5-year sentence for refusing a direct order. And then, you know, the military doesn't monkey around about obeying orders. You're supposed to do it. And so I was an E-4 by then, and I, but they, for some reason, they didn't give me a court-martial. They gave me an Article 15.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, are you still willing to go to Vietnam? And I said, yeah, I hadn't ever changed my thought on that. I believe in service and blah, 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 blah. I'm just not going to pick up that gun. And so since I was still willing to go to Vietnam, I guess they figured, why push it? You know, still some fresh meat here that they can send off to war. So they gave me an Article 15, which is what they call non-judicial punishment.
Right.
You know, you can either get court-martialed or you can get an Article 15. If you're not going to fight it, then they can, sometimes they'll give you an Article 15, and the sentence might be a little bit less.
Yeah.
And so they took my stripes and they confined me to barracks for a couple of weeks, which at that point I was married, and you know, I was kind of grumpy about that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my... the Army pay was so lousy that you know, I think I made I can't remember exactly how much I made, but it was very little, and the only way that I could keep food in the house for my wife when I got married, excuse me, when I got married, I had, you know, in those days we had a little mess hall, kind of like a bus pass or something, but it was your mess hall card. And because the mess hall for the medics working in the hospital was the hospital cafeteria at Madigan there. And so at lunch, I would go in there, and before I got married and I was living in the barracks, you know, I got all of my meals at the mess hall there. And so I had my mess hall card. And you know, a hospital visitor would go through the line and pay for whatever they got. But if you were a medic at the hospital, then you would just show your mess hall card and you didn't have to pay.
Hey, Randy.
So that was fine. So when I got married, I was supposed to give my mess hall card back to him, but I didn't do it. And I said, well, I burned my mess hall card because I didn't have a draft card. And by then I had kind of gotten a reputation as a little bit of a troublemaker, and so they believed me. And so then at lunch I would show my mess hall card, get food, and I would take half of it home and give it to my wife so that she'd have some food to eat. That's how poor we were.
Randy, we got to be real careful because we've only got one more time to dump if we cuss. We can't cuss because we got in trouble at the station here before. So we only got one more dump, so be real careful about cussing, okay?
Oh, okay.
Thank
Sorry.
You.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
You know, a couple guys sit around and start
I know.
Talking, you
know, I know. No problem.
I'll try to be good.
Yeah, we got only one more dump to go. So and we got like... Okay, go ahead. Go ahead and talk. I want you, now that you've got your orders, where did they send you after... Before you went to Vietnam, where did they send you?
Well, I got my orders, and after I did my 2 weeks of confinement to barracks, my orders were I was supposed to report. I went on leave, and I had a 45-day leave before I was supposed to ship out.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was supposed to report to Oakland Army Terminal, which is where guys went.
That's where I went through.
Sure. So my wife and I got in our car and drove down to the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. I didn't have any stripes, but and I was still on my way, but I'd kind of gotten, when they took my stripes away and confined me to the barracks, that did make me quite a bit more grumpy than I had been before. Each thing kind of step, put a step in the direction that I was headed in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got down to Berkeley, and we actually slept in like an abandoned building for a day or two until we found a place to rent. We rented this apartment, and quickly enough fell in with the movement, and we started going to the demonstrations that were raging in Berkeley, anti-war demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't take any time at all at demonstrations before we, it was just like, wow, police brutality. I mean, I literally saw, cops like
beating people. Yeah. Really?
It's like, really, this is America. This is the freedom and democracy that I'm supposed to go off to war to protect. I'd already turned against the war pretty much, but was still, had it in my head to do what I was supposed to do and, be obedient. But once I saw the mistreatment of the demonstrators, that pushed me over the line, and I said, I can't even go to Vietnam because I already know that we're doing the wrong thing to the Vietnamese because I'd heard all that from the guys I was taking care of at the hospital, and now the whole argument was, well, we got to go defend freedom and democracy, and I was witnessing a significant lack of freedom and democracy when I saw them mistreating the demonstrators, and so at a certain point, that was it. I just wasn't going to do it. And so the movement people said, well, if you're going to refuse to get on the plane, which was what I decided I was going to do, which is another 5-year opportunity to serve 5 years in prison, they said, if you're going to do that, you better get a lawyer. And so they turned me on to this radical lawyer in San Francisco, a guy named Terry Hallinan.
Oh.
And I talked to Hallinan and told him that I was planning on refusing to get on the plane. And he said, well, the last guys that did that, they just handcuffed him and threw him on the plane and off they went to the jungles. And, it was kind of hard to defend a guy over in Vietnam when his lawyer's in the United States.
Right.
And it's a 5-year sentence. He says, how about this instead? Why don't you go AWOL? Because if you're AWOL for 45 days, then you're dropped from the rolls is the technical term for it, which means you're no longer on orders for Vietnam.
Wow.
And then you'll put you in someplace or other, and you might get up to 6 months in the stockade, but that beats 5 years, and it'll give me a time, the lawyer, a time to do a more proper conscience objector application.
Mm-hmm.
One, and this time to do one that would say, the kind where you get out of the military or don't go in the military in the first place. And so that was the plan. I would be AWOL for 45 days and drop from the rolls and then face the music for that. But in the meantime, prepare a new application to be a conscience objector and try to get out of the Army, because I had turned against it, and you know, that was it. So that was the plan, and you know, we continued to live in Berkeley. I made a tactical error because I poured my heart out in a letter to my parents, telling them all about what I was going through and my thoughts about it and everything, and of course gave them my address, you know, just, you know, so we can stay in contact. And they, well, they turned that, they turned my address over to the authorities. And so one night there was that knock, knock, knock on the door, and it was a friendly knock at all. And so my wife went to the front door of the apartment to see who it was, and I went out the back door.
Good for you.
And just as I was jumping over the fence to get out of the backyard, why, on a different part of the fence, a cop came in the backyard. He was the guy that was supposed to have been covering the back door, I suppose. He was a little slow getting around there for some reason, and so, but he saw me going over the fence, so he gave chase. And along, right behind our house, there's all these railroad tracks that run along the west side of Berkeley and Oakland there. And so I just went running down the tracks in the dark of night, and the cop was behind me, but I outran him. Luckily,
good.
He didn't shoot me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I ended up just walking around, went up into the Berkeley Hills, and just walked into somebody's backyard and slept on their lawn furniture for the rest of the night. And then, realized I couldn't go back to my apartment, and so I called. I mean, there was no cell phones in those days; it was a landline. But you know, I called the apartment, and my wife came and met me somewhere. And you know, the cops kept raiding the place, which was awkward because our housemate was a guy who was in the Brown Berets, which was the Chicano version of the Black Panthers,
right?
And you know, he and his buddies would be there, and then the damn cops would come in trying to find me, and you know, that was, you know, unpleasant for everybody. So at any rate, we had a couple of other narrow escapes, and ultimately the movement said, well, it's getting pretty hot for you here. And so somebody turned me on to some, you know, like rich liberal or something, who had a cabin up in the woods in Mendocino County, Northern California. And so we went up and spent the rest of the summer up in that cabin, you know, our hideout. And so what I did while we were up there is work on my conscientious objector application. And so that by the time my 45 days were up, I would have a, you know, the parts, you know, the lawyer told me kind of what I was supposed to do. And, you know, so I was working on that. We spent the time in the woods. I had one other experience though I'll speak about, while we were in our hideout up in the woods there in the cabin. There wasn't much there, and so there wasn't anything to do, but there was a set of 1925 encyclopedias. And so to pass the time, my wife and I, each evening, we would take turns reading the encyclopedia to each other. And you know, what else are you going to do? And so we got all the way up to butter, and that really kind of stopped my show, because the entry for butter in this 1925 encyclopedia, which I was reading in 1968, many years, you know, quite a little while later. At any rate, the entry for butter was written by the butter franchise, and it was all about how the nefarious margarine people were trying to fool decent folks with this fake stuff, you know, and all, you know, it's an anti-margarine rant. And there it was in the encyclopedia. It was so obviously biased that when we got to that entry for butter, I was like, my mind was blown, because I had already lost faith in the commander-in-chief. I had lost faith in, you know, because it was, hey, LBJ, how many kids do you kill today?
Right.
You know, I had lost faith in the military hierarchy, and I had lost faith in the war. I had lost faith in just about everything, you know, all the authority figures and all that other stuff. But I still believed in the encyclopedia. You know, that was the truth, right? If you, you know, anybody, any kid in high school knows that if you wanted to find out about something, you would go to the encyclopedia, and you would you know, and that was, you know, that was just like the voice of God or something.
Yeah.
And there it was in this 1925 encyclopedia, so biased. And it occurred to me, well, if the 1925 encyclopedia was that biased, and I can see it now because there's been enough years have gone by, enough time that I have a little distance on it, and I can see the bias, then chances are a modern encyclopedia is just as biased, but I can't see it because I'm too close to it. You know, and that, you know, that was kind of like the last thing I, you know, every year nowadays I donate to Wikipedia, because Wikipedia is an encyclopedia, but that has a self-correcting yeah. mechanism in it to try and get the bias out. Excuse me.
Randy, let me ask you, how did you get into, let's jump forward now, and you're in the stockade at Presidio. So
I didn't quite get there yet, though.
How did you get in there? How did you get in the prison?
Well, so this is here's the story. So my 45 days was up, and now it was time to go face the music. And so I went back down and talked to Hallaman, the lawyer. He said, well, my 45 days is up, and, you know, da da da. And Hallaman says, well, you know, there's a big demonstration coming up in a week or so. It's going to be the very first GIs and veterans demonstration against the war, and it was going to happen there in San Francisco. And it was being organized by GIs and veterans. And in fact, it did happen. And it was, you know, a lot of soldiers turned out, some of them in uniform. A lot of them, if you ever look at photographs of the big GI and vets march for peace or against the war, whatever it was, the ones that didn't want to march in uniform because that was not allowed, they issued them like these paper hats, kind of like you know, soda jerk hats.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guys could be identified as a GI without having their uniform on, because they wore these little soda jerk hats. And there was a sea of little soda jerk hats and a few people actually in uniform, as well as, of course, all kinds of civilian supporters and that sort of thing. So it was a huge demonstration. So this was a week or two before the demonstration was to happen, and so my lawyer said, you know, the demonstration's coming up. It won't matter one way or the other, a week or two, in terms of your AWOL. But if you want to do an additional stand, a more political stand, why then, he was kind of organizing a thing where a few couple other guys were going to turn themselves in sort of ceremoniously at the end of the march. And I said, sure. It's sort of a two-for-one sale. I could, I had to turn myself in order to continue with the plan, to apply for conscientious objector discharge. But I could do it in conjunction with the march and, you know, get an extra mileage out of it, so to speak, by doing something for the movement. And so that was the plan. So we kind of hit out for another couple of weeks until the big march. And then I marched in the march and turned myself at the end.
How many guys turned themselves in with you?
Well, it was four of us total.
Okay.
And it was sort of patterned after something that had happened a couple of months earlier than that, which was the Nine for Peace,
mm-hmm.
which was nine GIs that had chained themselves to clergymen in a church in this Bay Area and more or less dared the Army to come get them. And, and it had made a lot of press. And the idea was to try and show the American public that the soldiers themselves had turned against the war. Because, of course, so much of the war propaganda, you know, in terms of trying to keep the public in support of the war was, well, you've got to support the troops. You know, you can't turn against the war because you've got to support the troops.
Right.
The truth is the troops were turning against the war, and so why in the world wouldn't the civilian population turn against the war, too? Because supporting the troops, if the troops were anti-war, you know, then being anti-war was in fact supporting the troops. And so that was kind of the concept. Now, the thing with it is that the GI and Vets March for Peace was going to happen on a Saturday. On Friday, I was meeting with the lawyer and the other movement activists and stuff about, you know, making the final plans for this thing that was going to happen the next day. And we got word that a prisoner in the stockade had been shot in the back and killed by a shotgun guard while he was out on work detail, and that there'd been a riot in the stockade that that Friday evening, you know, as the prisoners were angry about the fact that this prisoner had gotten murdered. And so Hallinan says, well, you're going to turn yourself in tomorrow. And since you're going to turn yourself in, and you're been AWOL, they're going to throw you in the stockade. And so when you go in the stockade, why don't you check out what the situation is, see if the prisoners want to take their anger about this guy getting killed to a higher level, maybe do a demonstration or something. And if so, see what you can pull together. And so we hatched this plan where I would turn myself in on Saturday and go to the stockade. And then on Sunday, Hallinan would come in to visit me because he was my lawyer. And he would come in to visit to find out, to get a report on what the situation was. And also to be able to coordinate, outside support if the soldiers had decided as he put it, take it to a higher level, do something that was more, more political in response to the murder of Richard Bunch was the guy, the name of the guy that had been killed. So we had the big march. I marched in the march, as I described earlier, and then I turned myself in. Gave a little speech, stepped over the line with the other guys that were turning themselves in. But for some reason, they didn't put me in the stockade. They put me in a special processing, or SPD, we call it, unit, and so there I was, unable to fulfill my mission, because my mission, my assignment by the movement was to go into the stockade and see if I couldn't organize some kind of a
protest.
So I thought, well, man, I have an assignment. I'm supposed to be in the stockade. So that Saturday evening, I went down to the orderly room. The orderly room, for people that haven't been in the military, is sort of like the business office of a military unit. And there's somebody in the orderly room day and night, 24 hours a day, that's, on call in case, some emergency arises or whatever. And so I went into the orderly room on Saturday night. And there was the old sergeant, was the guy on duty. And I walked up to him. He was just sitting there reading a Playboy magazine or something. And, nobody around. Nobody's doing anything. The place is quiet. Deserted, really. So I walked up to the old sergeant and I said, I'm refusing to sweep this floor on grounds of conscience. Well, nobody, of course, had asked me to sweep the floor. There was nobody sweeping floors or doing anything. It was evening time on a Saturday evening. Nothing was happening. But the old sergeant took the bait. He bit that hook. Just
started screaming and everything.
He was freaking out because I had refused to sweep a floor that nobody had actually asked me to sweep. And so he handcuffed me to the chair, and a half an hour later, I walked into the cell block in the Presidio stockade. And there's about 30 guys in the cell block, the big cell block. And I just announced to the guys, I said, I'm from the movement. They sent me in here to see if they could organize a demonstration or a protest or something about this guy getting killed. And everybody goes, cool. If you can imagine just walking into a prison and say that I'm from the movement, let's do something, and everybody just immediately falling into it. But that's exactly what happened. And so we started immediately having a meeting right there in the cell block. And as we started pulling it together, of course, people from other parts of the prison were, we had ways to communicate and get the word through and so by the time Hallinan came in on Sunday to visit me, we had had the outlines of what we were going to do. I gave him a copy of the list of demands, told him what we were going to do, and he promised to get the press there. So on Sunday we kind of had it all together. During the day on Sunday, of course, the whole question rattling around in the stockade was, are we going to do it? Are we not going to do it? How should we do it? Once we kind of hammered down what we were going to do, then really it was just sort of a gut check. Each guy saying whether or not he was going to do it or not. We knew by Sunday evening, we knew that the African-American prisoners were not going to sit down with us.
No, no way.
They had had a separate meeting, and among themselves, and decided, you know, we know that we're going to get punished a hell of a lot worse than,
yep,
than anybody else.
They would get, and, that's right.
And so, you know, it was one of these deals where we of course wanted them to participate, but on the other hand, we completely understood why they weren't going to do it.
Sure.
We were sympathetic to that. And so we accepted their decision. So when we went out to, the plan was on Monday morning at roll call formation, which we would have after breakfast. We'd go out there and have roll call and stand in the stockade yard, which was, you know, outside of the building, but inside of the big fence. We'd stand in a formation and then they have the roll call. And so the plan was that when they called the first name, whoever it was, didn't matter, but when they called the first name, then we would break ranks and walk over to a part of the stockade on the side of the building where you could see in through the fence. There was a road there, and we figured that if the press showed up, that then they'd at least be able to see what was going on. And so we walked over to that part and sat down and to do our protest. So that was the plan, and there was, you know, maybe 120 guys or 115 or 10. I don't know exactly what the count in the stockade was that morning. It was overcrowded because the stockade really was only built to hold about 60. But 28 guys walked over, broke ranks on the signal, broke ranks, walked over, sat down, linked arms. One guy almost immediately got up and went back in.
Ooh.
He told the authorities, I'll testify against those guys, but you know you can't leave me in the stockade because they'll kill me. And so they took him out of the stockade and put him in the SPD, at which time he immediately went AWOL. So he just used it as his ticket out of confinement.
Mm-hmm.
But he was never heard from again.
Right.
But that left 27 of us sitting on the grass. We linked arms. We sang "We Shall Overcome." You know, it was quite a diverse crowd. You know, in the sense that it was a gnarly bunch, to tell you the honest truth. I mean, there was a variety of people who had lived hard lives.
So what did they do? What, when you all sat down, I know one guy got up and read your what you wanted, you know, your
demands, yeah. Pulowski got up. He stood up and Walter Pulowski, who was a very popular guy in the stockade, a really smart guy, and he had volunteered to be the spokesman. We knew that anybody that was going to be considered a leader or a spokesman or anything would probably get punished worse. And so, the people really respected him for the fact that he says, "Well, you know, I'll do it," and he did. When we sat down, the brass came over and so Pulowski stood up, and we quit singing, and Pulowski started reading our demands,
mm-hmm.
Which were, you know, we wanted better treatment. You know, we'd been on, like, it turns out we didn't realize that somebody in the mess hall was stealing food. Some of the staff were stealing food or something, because we weren't getting proper rations, so they were actually having to stretch the food because they weren't getting enough food for as many guys as were in there.
Right.
So the food was scarce. Conditions were bad. One of the fellows that sat down, Roy Pulley, he had had an experience where the sergeant sat. You know, they had him on the floor. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And the sergeant bent his finger back just slowly until he broke his finger. Pulley's finger to this day still sticks out a little weird. And I mean, it was, you know, beat up prisoners and treat them badly. The guards were, most of them were just basket cases themselves. They were just back from Vietnam and
mm-hmm.
not really trained for confinement duty. And we had one guard one time, he was on acid or something, and he discharged a shotgun, blew a hole in the guard shack roof. Because he was just monkeying around with his gun, or
yeah.
You know, just weird. You know, it was one of those nightmare kind of situations.
So
at any rate, so Pulowski stood up and read the demands. And of course, they didn't want to hear the demands. And so, then the commandant, Captain Lamont was his name, he started reading us the Mutiny Act as if somehow that was going to make us all get up and be good. And we had already figured out that he was going to do that because he had read the assembled soldiers, the prisoners, the Mutiny Act after they had had a riot on Friday night. You know, then so we already knew that was his kind of his favorite response was to go for this Mutiny Act. Well, the problem with mutiny is it's the most serious military offense. Yeah, the way the regulations say is there is no maximum sentence, and the concept of mutiny is an important one because if one guy refuses to do something or misbehaves in somehow, it's not that hard for the military to take care of that, to isolate him and punish him and somehow. But if a bunch of guys do it together, well, then they've got a big trouble on their hands, and you know, cohesion and discipline breaks down really quickly. And so, you know, through all the centuries of warfare and military experience, they knew that when people get together, it's way more threatening to the power structure than one person doing an act of conscience or whatever. And so that's why mutiny is considered such a serious offense.
We got nine minutes. So, we got about 9 minutes.
Okay.
Once you guys got down there, he got up and said what he was going to do, what you guys wanted. What did they do? What did you guys do? Did you get up and go back in or what?
No, we just sat there because, you know, we didn't get a proper response. Because, you know, we tried to read our demands, Pulowski, you know, spokesman for all of us, to read our demands. And the commandant really didn't listen, and he just started trying to read the mutiny article. So we just went back to singing. and the idea was that if we sang loud, then we couldn't really hear him, and then we weren't really, you know, because we knew he would give us an order to disband and disperse. And we didn't want to get charged with the 5-year crime of refusing that order. So we figured, well, if we just sing really loud, we can't hear the order, and then, you know, nobody can really say that we heard it and disobeyed it.
Right.
When he started going that way, we just started singing loud, and every once in a while we'd break, and then we would, like, chant, for somebody higher up in the command structure, right? So we could bring our grievances to them. You know, that was the whole thing. It was a sit down. We had a set of grievances. We wanted to, register our grievances with somebody higher up in the command structure and get some changes made. And our grievances included stuff like we wanted psychological testing for the guards. You know, we wanted an end to racism. We included an anti-racism grievance or position in our demands because, even though the black guys weren't sitting with us, we understood the nature of racism. You know, I mean, we had solidarity, and so we included a thing against the war. We included a thing against racism, but mostly the demands were psychological testing of the guards, you know, and to the shotgun details, and, you know, which is where Bunch had gotten murdered sort of thing. So they, about that time, up on the other side of the fence, on that street where we thought the press would show up, who never did show up, they were stopped at the gate, I guess. But up comes the fire truck. I said, oh, doggone, man, they're going to squirt us with the fire hoses. But luckily for us, it was, although the fire company was on base, it was civilians that ran the fire department. And the fire chief, when they asked him to squirt us, he says, you know, that's not my job.
Wow, he refused. Good
so
deal.
He refused to squirt us. So eventually the fire truck drove away. But then up comes a whole company of MPs with their gas masks and their sticks and, you know, everything and, you know, sort of their riot duty stuff. And so then we didn't know what they were going to do. Maybe they're going to gas us, but we just kept singing. We didn't, I mean, truth is we didn't really have a plan for how to end the demonstration. and we hadn't gotten a response that we thought was adequate yet. And so, you know, I mean, the fool, the commandant, if he had just stood there and said, okay, I'll listen to your grievances, and went, and pretended to listen, we probably would have been satisfied. But he wouldn't do that. You know, he wouldn't even give us the time of day. So we just kept singing. And so up came the MPs, and eventually they decided that they were just going to disperse us by picking us up one at a time and carrying us back into the jail, into the building. And so, and that's what they did. Is they, you know, they, some people got up and walked, you know, under their own volition, you know, with guards hold them. Others had to be carried into the thing. But eventually we were all in. That was the end of the demonstration.
Yeah.
They did, in fact, charge us with mutiny. And as General Larson, who was the commander of the Sixth Army that had jurisdiction over us, they believed that the revolution was about to start. And they really wanted to make an example, you know, kind of a classic thing where you really, you know, whip the poor sailor, and then all the other sailors on the ship will pull their horns in and be good. Well, we were the guys who were going to get whipped in order to try and convince all the other soldiers not to buck the system or not to be against the war or, you know, whatever. And so they did. Then the first sentences were, you know, 15, 16 years. And that was guys that we thought would get off easy. I was one of the ringleaders, and so I was pretty sure I was going to get a lot worse than that. But the public outcry from the first sentences was so strong that the military realized that they had picked up a rock only to drop it on their own feet, and that they had a public relations problem now. So at a certain point they started reducing the sentences. By the time I got, I was in the last group to get court-martialed, and by the time I got sentenced, I only got like 15 months or something. I did a total of a year and a half in confinement. And then they decided to let us all out. So, you know, I was in Leavenworth by then, and they came up and they said, "Well, Roland, we're gonna give you parole." Well, I knew that only the suck bus got parole, so I figured, you know, I just said, "No way." I mean, I'm not, you know, forget it. I'll stay here. I'll just do my time. And no, really, really, we're gonna cut you loose. And the next thing I knew, there I was standing on the curb in this little white car coat that they gave every prisoner when they discharged them from the prison. That of course marked you to the community as a released prisoner.
Drop you off.
Everybody. and that was it. And I was free. You know.
Wow, that's really interesting. And I remember we heard about it in Vietnam. We heard about
it. Yeah, there was a lot of press.
Yeah, we heard about it in Vietnam. And a lot of guys, you know, we were really supportive of you, of what happened to you guys. And we were really, really supportive of you. And a lot of guys, you know, said, "Well, I'm not going to do anything. You know, if they send us out to the field, you know, we're only going to shoot back if they shoot at us, you know." Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys did that. That was pretty cool. But you guys, you know, by doing that, I think that really helped the movement inside the Army. You know, the morale within the active Army really fell. And you guys, you know, you guys were that. You did that for us. And I have a lot of respect for what you guys did. And it really gave us guys, you know, a reason to do what we were doing in Vietnam. And I really appreciate it. You know, every one of you guys that did that, I just really appreciate what you did. And, man, you stood by what you believed, Randy, and you still do it to this day.
Well, that's true. Yeah. It did turn me into a lifelong activist.
Yep.
You
know, that... Yep. Randy, I want to thank you for coming on and talking about this, and I really appreciate it, and I really have a lot of respect for you, and thanks a lot, buddy, and we'll talk to you later, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Randy. That's Randy Roland, and he was one of the Presidio 27 mutineers, and we'll be back on November 16th at 9 a.m., and there it is. Thank you.
the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KABU Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-